If you'd like to fasten your seat belts, this is one of those passages where it's not difficult to understand what it says, it's just difficult to do it. I don't know if you've ever thought about writing the Bible in text. I saw a website once where they had the Lord's Prayer in 160 characters or less. And it's quite a challenge, really. And I wonder if it was something similar when part of our Bible was written, because it was much more expensive then to write. You had to get a scribe, you had to pay someone, presumably, to deliver it, and words were perhaps a bit more precious than they are now. And I think some of the Bible, we sort of think, what a shame they didn't say this and they didn't explain that and didn't explain the other, but they really did not have the space to do it. And so what we've got is a very condensed version of what was on Paul's heart and mind when he wrote to the Thessalonians. And he wanted to explain to them, what does it mean to be church? What's it really all about? And part of what it means to be church is how we behave to outsiders. One of the definitions of a church is an organization that exists for the benefit of non-members. That we only exist really as a church until Christ comes again to be there for the world. And whilst we look at all our things that go on inside and we want to get those right, one of the best and most binding forces that will unite us is if we've all got one common purpose and we're all trying to do one thing and we're all trying to reach the world for God. And it explains then how we need to behave towards outsiders. When I was looking up illustrations for this, it seemed to me that there's, in this little piece of the Bible that we're looking at, just a couple of words that strike us, and they are loving and working. And apparently Sigmund Freud said that's what life is. All of life is either loving or working. That is life. So he's chosen two very good things, and Sigmund Freud, hundreds and hundreds of years later, recognized what a useful summary it is. So we're going to look at what it means to work and what it means to love. So we're looking at this passage, verse 9 to 11 of 1 Thessalonians 4, now about love for one another. We do not need to write to you, for you yourselves have been taught by God to love each other. In fact, you do love all of God's family throughout Macedonia, yet we urge you, brothers and sisters, to do so more and more. You are loving, you've started off on the right track, that's really good, but here he is, and he's not got much ink, and he's not got much parchment or vellum or whatever he was writing on, but he thinks, I need to tell them, you need to love one another, and you need to love one another more and more. And then he says, make it your ambition to lead a quiet life. You should mind your own business and work with your hands, just as we told you, so that your daily life may win the respect of outsiders and so that you will not be dependent on anyone. He tells them to work. Now, we think that one of the reasons he told them to work was that in Greek society at the time, which is the society that this church was living in, it was kind of considered as, if not a necessary evil, just not very the sort of thing to really focus on. You wanted to focus on your mind, and you wanted to get good ideas and pure and perfection things, and this work stuff was really not very important. And that was kind of the Greek culture. So when he was writing to them and saying, you should work, it was a countercultural message. The whole of society out there was saying, oh, you know, try and get by without doing any work. Try and have a, I don't know whether they were into passive income and all these things that we call it nowadays. Try and avoid this stuff of getting your hands dirty, and then you will be a better human, and you will be effectively more religious and more spiritual because you'll have more time to do that because you're not actually working. And so he was saying something that was really quite countercultural, and he was emphasizing it to these believers and saying, you need to work. And one of the reasons we think that he needed to emphasize it to the church in Thessalonica was that this church in Thessalonica was really quite excited that Jesus is coming again. So excited that they kind of thought, well, that's the most important thing. And if Jesus, maybe Jesus is coming tomorrow. Well, maybe I won't have to pay this month's mortgage because Jesus is coming very soon. So why do I need to work? Why do I need to do all of this sort of stuff? And so they were apparently, you know, trotting up mountainsides so as to be, you know, nearer the top when everybody was raised up again, and not working. And what effectively was happening, therefore, is that they were sponging off the other people who were working, and they were becoming dependent. They were making more work for the rest of them. And Paul had to write to them and say, that's not what you need to do. You need to work with your own hands so that you are not going to be dependent and make other people have to work harder for you. But let's have a look, first of all, at love. Love all of God's family more and more. It's a teaching which Jesus had given in that Last Supper when he washed the disciples' feet and he was explaining, and he didn't have much time left. One of the things he said to his disciples is, a new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, everyone will know that you're my disciples if you love one another. It's very similar to what Paul was writing, therefore, to the Thessalonians. Love one another more and more so that the outsiders will notice. It will make a difference. It will make an impact on the outsiders. And he seems to have repeated it even in this letter. So in chapter 3 and verse 12, he says something very similar. May the Lord make your love increase and overflow for each other and for everyone else. I think sometimes in our church nowadays, we are encouraged to love the world. How are we going to give the message of God to the world if we don't love them? We must show compassion to the world. And that's very true. And that's what it says here. And yet, it starts off by saying, your love for one another. There's an old-fashioned saying that says, charity begins at home. If you can't love one another, it's a good place to start practicing, and then you can overflow with love to the world. And so Paul was saying, you need to show love for one another. You need to be united and loving together. I remember hearing about a person who was going to do a mission. And evangelist, he was invited into a church and came along to the church meeting. And he had a slot that he was going to stand up and say how he was going to lead the church in the mission. But first of all, he had to sit through all the church business. And when it got to his thing, he stood up and he said, I'm not really sure I want to run a mission for this church to bring people in to listen to you lot bickering and arguing and fighting and disputing, and just not showing love for one another. We need to show love for one another. That's part of our witness. By this, everyone will know, said Jesus, that you are my disciples, that you love one another. So practically, what would we expect to see if we did love one another? So if you have a look, it comes up very easily on the internet. You can find out 10 signs that will tell you if he's in love with you. This, I do worry sometimes about what the internet is telling me about myself, because I don't know if you know, the search engines are supposed to be tuned to your personal things. And it seems to me there's things telling women how they know that a man's in love with them. But the other way around, I didn't seem to come up very much for me. Anyway, how does a woman know that the fella is really in love with him. And it comes up with 10 things, you know, treats you with respect, and he's always thinking about you, and he compromises, he's willing to sort of adjust his life around you. He wants to be near you, wants to be touching you, he wants to be close to you, he wants to take care of you, he wants you to be involved in his family life, he wants to introduce you to people and friends and families. He's not afraid to actually really engage with you. He's not just being polite and an acquaintance. He's really trying to get emotionally close to you. He starts talking about us and not just talking about what I'm going to do. And when he talks of the future, he includes you in it and he tells you that he loves you. And I wonder just how many of these things are for us to take on board. For how do we know that we're fulfilling Jesus' command and Paul's exhortation for us to love one another more and more? Isn't it to treat one another with respect? Perhaps it is to be thinking of one another all the time, to be longing to be with each other. What does it say to outsiders if they come into a church and we're all sitting in opposite corners in our favorite pew and we don't want to be near to other people? Surely part of our witness is that we enjoy being with each other. Loving one another more and more, surely we would want to be with each other more and more. And I find this very challenging because we've got lots of things to fit into our lives. But we always seem to fit in the most important things to us. What is most important to us? Is it loving one another more and more in order to be the disciples of Jesus? But how can we do this? How can we love one another more and more? Where does it come from? Where does the strength, the energy, the excitement, the enthusiasm for this come from? And in the passage that we've got here, it actually mentions a word that Paul invented. Apparently, it's nowhere else in the New Testament, and I don't think it's anywhere else in Greek. But Paul invented this word. It's obviously what it means because it's God taught. And you can see what it means. But he just invented this word. He made it into one word. And he said, you have been taught by God. You are God taught to love one another. About your love for one another, we do not need to write to you, for you yourselves have been taught by God to love one another. So if you're struggling and thinking, how can I put this into practice? How can I love more and more the people that I'm supposed to be with in this church? Part of the answer is God will teach you. If you really want to know, God will teach you. And part of the answer is the Holy Spirit. It's not an accident that that verse about being taught by God, verse 9, is immediately after verse 8, which mentions God who gives you the Holy Spirit. And many of you will know that lovely verse in Galatians that says the fruit of the Spirit is, amongst other things, love. And by God's Holy Spirit, we will have this love. So it's not something that we're going to find some sort of technique for, some sort of method for, some sort of formula for. It's something that God, by his Holy Spirit, helps us with and brings into fruition in our lives, that we can love more and more. So that's love, and we're also going to think about work. Working with your hands. Mind your own business and work with your hands. I don't think, when I look at it and think Paul was writing to these people who thought that working with your hands was second rate and not important, I don't think it means that for us in our society we all need to not work except with our hands, if you see what I mean, that only working with our hands is good work. I think he was trying to make the point that we need to be able to be in a position where we're not dependent on other people, where we're contributing and we're doing the work. Mind your own business and work with your hands. And then he has this amazing phrase, make it your ambition to lead a quiet life. Make it your ambition, which kind of means an ambition is something for which you restlessly strive. So restlessly strive to lead a quiet life. It's quite a juxtaposition of ideas, but it makes you think of that one of those dreaded interview questions. So, John Shepherd, where do you want to be in 5 years' time? One of those tricky questions. What are you supposed to say? Well, apparently, you need to not sort of say that you want to be doing something completely different, because that implies that the job that they're offering you is not what you really want. So apparently, you're supposed to say three things. I want to have done well in the job. I want to have taken on extra responsibilities. And I want to be ready for promotion. So that implies that you'll still be happy with the job, but you'll be perhaps ready to be stretched and challenged a bit more. And that is what you're supposed to say when you get asked this question, where do you want to be in 5 years' time? What is your ambition? And Paul says, make it your ambition to lead a quiet life. And I found this little video about a quiet life.
A quiet life sounds like an option that only the defeated would ever be inclined to praise. Our age is overwhelmingly alive to the benefits of active, dynamic, noisy ways of living. If someone offered us a bigger salary for a job elsewhere, we'd move. If someone showed us a route to fame, we'd take it. If someone invited us to a party, we'd go. These seem like pure, unambiguous gains. Lauding a quiet life has some of the eccentricity of praising rain. Partly that's because the defenders of quiet lives have tended to come from the most implausible sections of the community. Slackers, hippies, the work shy, the fired, people who seem like they've never had any choice about how to arrange their affairs. A quiet life just seems like something imposed on them by their own ineptitude. And yet, when we examine matters closely, busy lives do often turn out to have certain strikingly high incidental costs that we often ignore. For a start, we have very limited control over our time once we reach a certain position in society. We may be able to shut down a factory in India, and our every word is listened to with trembling respect within our firm. But what we absolutely cannot do is admit that we're also extremely tired and just want to spend the afternoon reading on the sofa. We can no longer express our more spontaneous, imaginative, vulnerable sides. Along the way, we grow strangers to those who love us outside of our wealth and status. Our children see less of us. Our spouses grow bitter. We may own the wealth of continents, but it might have been 10 years at least since we last had the chance to do nothing for a day. The most famous cultural figure in the history of the West was someone very interested in the benefits that can attend quiet lives. In the Gospels, Jesus tells his disciples to take nothing for their journey except a staff, no bread, no bag, no money in their belts, but to wear sandals and not to put on two tunics. Christianity opens up vital space in our imaginations by making a distinction between two kinds of poverty, what it terms voluntary poverty on the one hand and involuntary poverty on the other. We are at this point in history so fixated on the idea that poverty must always be involuntary and therefore the result of a lack of talent that we can't even imagine that it might be the result of an intelligent and skilled person's free choice based on a rational evaluation of costs and benefits. It might sincerely be possible for someone to decide not to take the better paid job, not to publish another book, not to seek high office, and to do so not because they had no chance, but because, having surveyed the externalities involved, they chose not to fight for them. One of the central moments in Christian history came in 1204, when a wealthy young man we know today as St. Francis of Assisi willingly renounced his worldly goods, of which he had quite a few, a couple of houses, a farm, and a ship at least. He did so not through any external compulsion. He just felt that they would interfere with other things he really wanted rather more of, a chance to contemplate Jesus' teachings, to honour the creator of the earth, to admire the flowers and the trees, and to help the poorest in society. For its part, Chinese culture has been equally reverent towards what it calls the yinshi, or recluse, Someone who chooses to leave behind the busy political and commercial world and live more simply, usually up the side of a mountain in a hut. The tradition began in the 4th century AD when a high-ranking government official named Tao Yuanming surrendered his position at court and moved to the countryside to farm the land, make wine, and write. In his poem, On Drinking Wine, he recounts the riches that poverty have brought him. Plucking chrysanthemums from the eastern hedge, I gaze into the distance at the southern mountain. The mountain air is refreshing at sunset as the flocking birds are returning home. In such things we find true meaning, but when I try to explain, I can't find the words. There are for many of us plenty of options to take up certain career paths that carry high prestige with them. We could have something deeply impressive to answer those who ask us what we do at parties. But this doesn't necessarily mean we must or should follow these possibilities. When we come to know the true price that some careers exact, we may slowly realize that we're not, in fact, willing to pay for the ensuing envy, fear, deceit, and anxiety. Our days are limited on this earth. We may, for the sake of true riches, willingly and with no loss of dignity, opt to become a little poorer and a little more obscure.
Thought-provoking, isn't it? Make it your ambition, says Paul, to lead a quiet life, a life where you can have time to do the things that really matter, a life that is not so much about impressing other people, but about doing the right thing. And all of this was said because of the witness that he wanted to encourage the church to be involved in. Because all of this was about loving and working so that, he says in verse 12, so that you may have a good witness amongst outsiders. Your daily life may win the respect of outsiders, and so that you will not be dependent on anybody. That's what it's all about. So, yes, it's about love. Yes, it's about work. But in our church, we think about welcome and witness and worship. This is about witness. It's important that we love one another. It's important that we work. It's important that we make it our ambition to lead a quiet life because we want to witness. And it's a way of witnessing and fulfilling what a church is all about. A church isn't a building. A church is us. And that means a loving people and a working people, a people who can win respect so that when outsiders ask what we're about, they have an impression of the church that it's something that they'd like to be part of, and not something that's going to ask them for their money, but something that's going to be a place to join into, a place that would be attractive. And I remember, some of you will remember Bob and Lisa Stimson, who used to come here. And Bob started coming first, and Jem used to tell the story of how he heard once, after Lisa had been brought along to see what a service was like, he heard them out on the pavement arguing. And Lisa said, "Why didn't you tell me it was so good? Why, you didn't tell me, you just said you liked going there. You didn't say it's brilliant like that. You didn't say it was full of lovely people and so on. Why didn't you tell me?" And that's what we want our church to be like.